Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Riddell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlow. Chapter 10, Unrest. It was as hot as it can be now and then during the fierce brief summer of the north, and the perspiration rose in beads on the crown recorder's face as he stood on the rude veranda of his log-built dwelling, looking down at the tents and shanties which showed here and there amidst the pines. He was a little man with a quiet and almost expressionless face, and attired, although he lived far remote from civilization in the wilderness, with a fastidious neatness which, with the erectness of his carriage, furnished a hint as to his character. There was, however, nothing that any one could have termed finicking about him. He was precise, formal, and unemotional, a man of fixed opinions, as little to be moved by argument as by any attempt at compulsion. For Recorder Eshelby was one of the insular Englishmen who, when entrusted with authority on the outskirts of the empire, are equally capable of adding to their nation's credit, or involving it in difficulties by their soulless and undeviating regard for its law. There are a good many of them, and while occasionally respected, they are, as a rule, not greatly loved in any of England's dependencies. Sitting in the shadowy room behind him, a hard-bitten Canadian of a very different stamp watched Eshelby with an ironical twinkle in his eyes. He had won his promotion on merit in the Northwest Police, and there was red dust on his faded uniform, which showed a roughly stitched-up rent here and there. Outside, the sun glare was dazzling, and when he turned his eyes from Eshelby, he could see the peaks gleaming with a hard whiteness against the blue. They were by no means high, for the level of perpetual snow is low in that country, and it was only on the eastern hand that they rose to any elevation. West and north, a desolation of swamp muskeg, where few living creatures could face the mosquitoes, rock and river, stretched back to the Yukon, and Eshelby was there to carry out the mining laws of that district, which are less lenient than those of the province to the south of it. Valley was very still, and the drowsy fragrance of the firs crept into the dwelling, but Slavin, who would sooner have heard the clatter of shovels or the crash of a blasting charge, was not in the least deceived. He knew that unusual quietness now and then presages a storm, and he had felt that there was a tension in the atmosphere for some little time. He smiled, however, when Eshelby glanced into the room. "If they do not turn up in another minute, I will walk across to the outpost with you," said the latter. "The time is up." He spoke concisely with a clean English intonation, and as usual betrayed no impatience, but Slavin fancied that he was by no means pleased at the fact that a band of miners with grievances should presume to keep him waiting for even a few moments. "I guess they'll come," he said. "If I were you, I'd promise them something, if it's only to humor them." Eshelby glanced at him coldly, for he was not, as a rule, addicted to considering any advice that might be offered him. "A concession," he said, "is usually regarded as a sign of wavering. In dealing with a mob of this kind, firmness is necessary." Slavin made a little gesture and smiled in a somewhat curious fashion. He had shepherded the Blackfeet on the plains, as well as put down whiskey runners and carried out the prohibition laws, and he knew that to gain an end, one must yield a point occasionally. It was, however, not his business to instruct the Crown Recorder, and Eshelby seldom deviated a hair's breadth from the course he had once decided on. Well, said Slavin, I guess I hear them, and I'll stay right where I am. They can't see me in the shadow, and if they knew I was hanging around, it might worry them. You don't want to hang out a red rag when you have a difference of opinion with a bull. He moved his chair back a little farther from the door, when a murmur of voices and patter of feet came up through the dimness beneath the stunted pines, for he was quite aware that his warning was not likely to restrain Eshelby from a display of the exasperating crimson on the smallest provocation. Then he leaned forward, with a quiet intentness in his eyes, as a group of men came out of the shadows. They were dressed for the most part in soil-stained jean, and were all of them spare of flesh and sinewy. They had bronzed faces with a significant grimness in them, and moved with a certain air of resolution that did not astonish Slavin. They were hard men. English, Canadians, Americans, Teutons by birth, though that meant very little to most of them then, men who had faced many perils, and borne as much privation as flesh and blood is capable of. To men of their kind, all countries are the same, and they have not, as a rule, any particular tenderness for the land, which had in their phraseology no use for them. They had also, or at least so they thought, legitimate grievances, for the exactions of the crown were heavy, and it is because the opinions of such as they were are seldom listened to that news now and then reaches England, which is unpleasant to complacent optimists with imperialistic views. The wonder is, however, that the latter are not more frequently disturbed in their tranquility, for even when peace and prosperity are proclaimed at St. Stephen's, there is usually and probably must necessarily be all around the fringe of the empire a vague unrest, which is occasionally rife with unpleasant probabilities. The men of the outer marches have primitive passions, and, or they would in all probability, never have been there at all, an indomitable will. Slavin, at least, understood them, and knew that while it is well to keep a tight grasp on the reins, it is not always advisable to make those driven unduly sensible of it. The two who came foremost stopped in front of the veranda, and one of them was a well-favored man with restless dark eyes. Slavin fancied he had seen the picture of somebody very like him in an American paper. The rest waited a few yards away, and the man with the dark eyes greeted Eshelby, who responded with a curtest inclination, courteously. "We have come for an answer to the request we handed you," he said. Eshelby glanced at him coldly. "You are a free miner. What is the name on your certificate?" "Sewell," said the other. "You may perhaps have heard of it." Slavin started a little and then smiled to himself, for there was at least no sign in the recorder's face that he attached any particular significance to the announcement. "Well," he said, "I have, as I promised, glanced at what you are pleased to term your request, though it bears a somewhat unfortunate resemblance to a demand." "We're not going to worry about what you call it," said the man who had not spoken yet. "We've come here so you can tell us what you mean to do." Eshelby smiled a little, though it would have been wiser if he had refrained from it. "Personally," he said, "I can do nothing whatever." There was a low murmur, with an unpleasant note in it, from the rest of the deputation. The curt non-possumus is usually the last resource of the diplomatist when argument has failed, and it very seldom makes for peace, as everybody knows. Slavin wondered why the crown authority should have inflicted upon him such a man as Eshelby, when his burden was already sufficiently heavy. "Well," said the miner grimly, "something's got to be done. We'll let you know what we wanted. Haven't you anything to say?" "Only that I shall send your petition to the proper quarter." "I wonder," said Sewell dryly, "if you would tell us what is likely to be done with it there?" "It will receive attention when the department is at liberty to consider it," Sewell laughed. "Presumably at any time during the next 2 years. Can you guarantee that it will not be neatly docketed and put away forever?" And, said one of the men who stood behind, we may be dead by then. How are we going to worry through when the snow comes and it's going to cost a fortune to get provisions in, when the crown takes the big share of what most of us make? Eshelby did not even look at the last speaker as he answered Sewell. I certainly can't guarantee anything, he said. There was a little murmur from the men. But Sewell raised his hand restrainingly. We had, he said with a quietness which had nevertheless a suggestion of irony in it, the honor of pointing out to you some of our difficulties, and suggesting how they could be obviated. We may now take it that you can give us no assurance that the matter will ever receive the attention we at least think necessary. I am, said Eshelby, not in a position to promise you anything. The petition will be submitted to men qualified to deal with it, with a recommendation that, as the matter is urgent, it should be looked into. Eshelby straightened himself a trifle. My views will be explained to those in authority. I do not recognize any necessity for laying them before you. The rest of the deputation had drawn a little closer to Sewell, and Slavin was watching their faces intently. He felt that unless they had confidence in their leader, and he was endued with all the qualities necessary for the part, there was trouble on hand. Sewell, who made a little forceful gesture as he glanced at the rest, was, however, apparently still master of the situation. Then he said, there is in the meanwhile nothing you can suggest. I fancied you understood that already, said Eshelby. If those whose business it is think fit to modify the regulations you complain of, I will let you know. Unless that happens, they will be adhered to as usual, rigorously. His cold, even voice was in itself an aggravation, and Slavin, who saw one of the deputation move forward with a little glow in his eyes, rose sharply to his feet. He, however, sat down again next moment with a smile, for Sewell quietly laid his hand upon the man's arm, and the rest stood still in obedience to his gesture. Slavin was not astonished, for he, too, was a man who understood how to wield authority. Then, said Sewell, we need not waste any more of your time. We have heard nothing that we did not expect, boys, and now we at least know where we stand. He turned once more to Eshelby, raising his wide hat, and then moved back into the shadow of the pines, taking care, as Slavin noticed, that the others, who did not seem greatly desirous of doing so, went on in front of him. The recorder glanced at Slavin complacently when they disappeared. A little firmness is usually effective in a case of this kind, he said. I will, of course, send on the petition, but as I scarcely suppose it will be referred to again, we can consider the affair as closed. Slavin smiled. I'm not quite so sure as you seem to be. The fellow's last remark was a significant one. And he's not the kind of man to stand still anywhere very long. Anyway, he and you between you have forced my hand, and while I have got to take your lead, the game is going to be a risky one. Eshelby sat down with a little gesture, which implied that he had already given the trifling affair rather more attention than it merited, and Slavin went out to take such proceedings as appeared advisable, though it was not until that night that the result of them became evident. Sewell was then sitting with 8 or 9 men in the general room of Hobson's Oregon Hotel. It had walls of undressed logs, but the roof was still of canvas, for Hobson had been too busy watching over his interests and several profitable claims and dispensing deleterious liquor to split sufficient cedar. There was another room in the building in which he slept with any newcomer who was rash enough to put his hospitality to the test. Rather more than 100 miners were at work in that valley, but only a few whose views and influence with the rest were known had been invited to attend the conference. The room was foul with tobacco smoke and the reek of kerosene, for the big lamp smoked when the roof canvas flapped now and then. Sewell sat in a deer-hide chair with a pipe in his hand, and a man with a grim bronzed face and a splendid corded arm showed through the torn sleeve of his shirt, was speaking. He spoke quietly and like a man of education. "We have," he said, "as our host has pointed out, done the straight thing and given constituted authority a show. The constituted authority, as usual, prefers to do nothing. We naturally consider our grievances warranted, but I need not go into them again. Some of us risked our lives to get here. The rest will probably do so by holding on through the winter, and considering how we work, it is not exactly astonishing that we wish to take back a little gold with us, which we are scarcely likely to do under the present regulations. I, however, fancy the position is plain enough to everybody."
"The question is, Hobson," said another man, "is how it's going to be altered."
"By kicking," said Hobson dryly. "You want to start it hard and stay right there with it." There was a murmur of approval, and a man stood up.
"That, I guess, is just the point. Who's to begin and when?" he said. "There's mighty little use in three or four of us wearing our shoes out before the rest. No, sir. Slavin would come round with his troopers and run those men out."
Sewell nodded. "Our friend has hit it. We have got to go slow," he said. "There are at least 100 men in this valley, and a good many more with the same grievances farther west, without mentioning the Green River country, where the regulations are easier. Now it will be your business to go round and make sure of the men here joining us. A good many of them are ready, and will strike when you can get the rest. The kick will have to be unanimous."
"That's so," said another man. "Lie low until we're ready. Well, when the time comes, you'll have your program?"
Sewell leaned forward in his chair with a little glow in his eyes.
"Then," he said, "we will, for one thing, show Recorder Eshelby out of the valley by way of a protest, and if it appears necessary, as it probably will do, seize Slavin's armory. We'll make our regulations and give the Crown people a hint that they had better sanction them."
There was a little hum of approbation, and a man stood up.
"I guess that's the platform," he said. "Half the men in this country are Americans, and Alaska is not so far away. Once we show we mean it, they're coming right in, and when we start twisting the beaver's tail, we're going to get some backing at home. Do you know any reason why we shouldn't send somebody down south to whip up a campaign fund? There was plenty of money piled up when the Chicago Irishmen were going over to ask why the British nation threw out the Home Rule Bill."
Most of the others laughed, but while there was no expression of sympathy, it was significant that there was as little astonishment. Visionaries talked of founding a new republic in the North just then, and some of annexation, but still the beaver flag flapped over every government outpost. There were many men with grievances in that country, but they knew the world and were far from sure that there was anything to be gained by changing their accustomed burden for what might prove to be a more grievous one. There were others who, while by no means contented with the mining regulations, were still characterized by the sturdy imperialism which is to be met with throughout most of Canada. Hobson turned to the speaker with a whimsical grin. "The Chicago Irishmen stayed right where they were," he said. "I don't know what they did with the money, but they bought no rifles. They weren't blame fools. The moral is that what an Irishman looks at twice is too big a thing for us. No, sir, you wouldn't raise $10 in a month down there. America has all the trouble she has any use for already. What we want to do is put up a good big bluff, and no more than that, on the British Empire."
"How's the Empire going to take it?" asked another.
Sewell smiled.
"Patiently, I think, that is, if we go just far enough and know when to stop. They move slowly in England. I was born there, and I'm not sure they're very much quicker in Ottawa. In fact, they rather like an energetic protest, and you very seldom get anything without it. Once we show we're in earnest, they'll send over a special commissioner with instructions to make any concessions he thinks will please us."
"There are Slavin and his troopers to consider,"
said the man who had spoken first. They're not going to sit still. And if any of them got hurt during the proceedings, it's quite likely we might be visited by a column of Canadian militia. Others commenced to speak, two or three together, in fact, but Sewell raised his hand. That eventuality will have to be carefully guarded against, he said. Slavin seems to be a man of ability and sense, and he would never pit his handful of troopers against 100 men. In the meanwhile, everything depends on secrecy, and no move must be made until you are sure of everybody. I will answer for the Green River men. I'm going back there shortly. Then they put their heads together to consider a scheme, and there was only a low hum of voices until Hobson stood up suddenly. A tramp of feet and a sharp order rose from outside. Slavin and the troopers, he said. We don't want him to know who's here. Get out through the roof, boys. Put the lamp out. It was done. And while a sound of ripping and scrambling became audible in the black darkness, Hobson touched Sewell's arm. You and I have got to see it out. I guess he's sure of us, he said. In another moment or two, somebody beat upon the door, and getting no answer, drove it open. Then a sulfur match sputtered, and the trooper who stood in the entrance turned to a man behind him. There are only two men here, sir, he said. Light that lamp, said the other man. I feel tolerably certain there were considerably more. Hobson stood forward when the feeble light of the blue flame made him dimly visible. I guess it's broke, he said. Bring Rignon's lantern, said the man in the darkness. It was at least a minute before another trooper appeared with a light, and Sewell surmised that his companions had made good use of the time. Slavin, who, as he quite expected, was standing in the doorway, seemed to realize it too, for he glanced at the torn canvas. I might have thought of that, he said. You and Rignold will start down the trail and stop any man you come across. Though I guess they're back in their tents or in the bush by now. The trooper went out, and Slavin turned to Hobson with a smile on his face. We've got you, anyway, and you'll spend tonight at least in the outpost. Tomorrow I'll look into the question of the liquor sale permits, and it's quite likely this saloon will be closed. I'll have to take you along as well, Mr. Sewell. Sewell made a good-humored gesture of resignation. I suppose I'll have to come. It's a proceeding I'm not altogether unaccustomed to. Still, I'm not sure there is any charge you can work up against me. Slavin looked at him almost appreciatively. Well, he said, I fancy you're not going to make any trouble here. In fact, it's very probable that you will leave this settlement early tomorrow, though it would have been a good deal better had I choked you off from coming here. I would have done it had I known who you were. You will take any steps that seem necessary if these gentlemen try to get away, Trooper Nixon. Sewell spent that night at the outpost, but not in the same room with Hobson, and when he had breakfasted tolerably well, Slavin came in. Your horse is waiting, and you will start at once, for wherever you like, so long as it's outside my boundaries. Though I may as well mention that every officer in the district will be warned against you, he said. If you feel yourself aggrieved, you can, of course, complain to Victoria. Sewell made no protest. When he knew it would be useless, he seldom did. And Slavin, who handed him several days' provisions, waited until he swung himself into the saddle. It wouldn't be wise to push your luck too hard by coming back, he said. Sewell smiled from the saddle and rode away. He knew that the seed was sown, and need only to be left to spring and ripen, though he would have felt easier had he been sure that Slavin did not know it, too. Eshelby could be trusted to stimulate the growth of the crop, but he had already grasped the capabilities of the quiet police officer, who, it was evident, was a very different kind of man. Join me next week on the Sagebrush Trail for more Adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaws.